Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're talking with Francois Clemens about his new book, Officer Clemens. Clemens is best known for playing Officer Clemens on the long-running children's program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but he's also performed in operas and toured around the world with his Harlem Spiritual Ensemble. Francois, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. I hope these mechanical things work out for us.
Yes, I think we're out of the woods now. So I'd love to start by talking about your childhood. You grew up in Blackwater, Mississippi.
My family was there.
Your family was there.
I was so young, I don't remember that. I didn't really start thinking about stuff until we got to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So there was a history in Blackwater, but I really only remember Tuscaloosa and Birmingham, Alabama, where originally I had been born before they went over to Mississippi and New Orleans. But so my real reason for including that was so that people would understand what I would consider an earthy beginning rather than in a big city like Birmingham. So I gave additional information, but my mother was my main source of the specific things that happened and the specific cities we were in. You know, a kid does not remember Blackwater or anything until you're about two years old, maybe.
Yeah. And even then, it's pretty hazy.
Yeah. Other than that, it's hazy. Except I kept asking my mother, where's my father? Where's my great-grandmother? You know, where's going on? And at first, she didn't want to talk about it. It was very, very painful for her. But eventually, I got her to start talking about our lives in Tuscaloosa and in Birmingham. And over in Mississippi, she talked about it, but not you know, extravagantly or great detail. She was very terse because it was a bad memory for her and the pain for when I was growing up. My parents had a difficult relationship, to say the least. So I tried to write about it, you know, very honestly in the book. But sometimes it was very painful to go back and remember that nightmare that my father and my mother put me through as a young boy, me and my brother. I have an older brother. And much later, I was able to talk with him about what it was like. And he remembered a little more than I did. And he generally, there was a consensus that our parents just shouldn't have gotten married.
Yeah.
They did not get along well at all. And a lot of the source of difficulty and pain was that my father belonged to an old school, which doesn't make sense to us, but he felt that my mother should obey him. Mm-hmm. And if she decided to do something else or express another opinion, he was very, very adamant against it. He did not tolerate her individuality. And that was the source of their combat. I hate to say that word, combat.
Yeah.
But you know, they. I also saw some things as a child that left me traumatized, and one was the knife and the blood. Years later, I realized why I had such incredible trepidation about using a knife to cut butter or to cut bread, something simple. And I never liked it. And when I went into therapy, and when I spoke with my psychiatrist, he said to me, "These are memories from your childhood, Francois. You have to go back. You have to see them. And then maybe, if you can, you have to forgive them. There's a letting go instead of holding on to it and holding on to the pain." And through that process, I healed myself by saying, "I don't want to hate anybody. I want to forgive and let it go." And it's like a big weight, huge, let off of my chest, because I'm not a person who is so fighting, so disagreeable that you get guns out and things like that. Well, there were people around us who did. Mm-hmm. And my true saving grace was learning to let it go. And when I did, I was able to, it was like a release in my life, a certain freedom. I'm very grateful that happened. And so when I got to Youngstown, Ohio, I was only 5 or 6 years old, but I felt a freshness, something else opening up in terms of life, more opportunities, nice people. At that age, I was able to be outside of the family and go to the community settlement house, and I met people there and played games. After being with Fred all those years, he talked about how important it was for children to play. And I was so sad, I was traumatized, and I didn't talk or communicate very much. But after a short time, the counselors and the people who were running this community center talked to me individually, spent a lot of time. It was very nurturing. And I began to talk to them, and then they encouraged me to mix and talk with the other children, and I began to play again. And in my opinion, that playing was part of what healed me from the trauma of my youth.
Mm. I got the sense reading the book that your home wasn't always the most nurturing or comforting place, but that you found other people in your life who were able and willing to kind of play that nurturing maternal or paternal role for you. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I went through a very special kind of understanding the issue of trust. Mm-hmm. Who was I going to trust? And I have to tell you that it was very hard to trust my parents, so I didn't. I began to realize that complete strangers were very nice to me. And when they were very nice to me, they made me want to mix with them more and more. And so I would sit, you know, a young person sitting and saying, "My parents say they love me, but they're behaving in a horrible way." So maybe that stranger has a key to something, a clue to what my childhood needed. And so I began to spend time with that stranger, and they really were sent from God, like an angel. And then I would find another person and another one at my church. I spent a lot of time at church, and those lady deaconesses kind of took over a certain kind of education, where they would take me to concerts and to parks like what we call Kenny, or Idora was what it's called in Youngstown, but it's a where you have the roller coaster and kind of go around the merry-go-round. And they began to do those kind of things. My parents did not. I don't know why. My father could have done that and should have done it. Well, he didn't. And when I got to Youngstown, the ladies, the deaconesses at the church, it was almost like every week somebody would say, "Okay, this is your turn. This is your turn. And this is your turn." And they helped to bring me out still even more, because I could read. I had no trouble with mathematics, no trouble with the basics, spelling and writing. I love to hear them tell me stories about what it was like down south. And that's where all this basically comes from, those stories that my mother and my aunts told me about what was going on. And I listened very, very intently. I wanted to know what was back there, what was happening. And because of the pain associated with my mother, she couldn't talk about it in detail. So my aunts began to tell me privately what had happened. And it was just such a shock. To have it verbalized with such authority and such specificity. They knew what had happened, and they were much older, of course, but they told me, and I sat there like a child just absorbing this poison. It was awful. I really mean it. If you see people on television rioting and you see those police and all that, that's what it felt like. My parents fighting was a very, very, very painful experience.
Yeah. So, and but your aunts were kind of willing to step into that role as well a bit and kind of fill in those details that your parents wouldn't talk about.
You know, it's interesting in a community like that. It's not considered an intellectual community or a community of financial wealth or anything, but it almost seems like everybody knew Francois was traumatized and he needed just a little bit more care and love and nurturing. Mm-hmm. And they gave it to me. I went to my aunt's house because I knew she was going to hug me and put me on her lap or feed mm-hmm. me. And I went to another aunt. I had about five of them, Aunt Cora, Aunt Hattie, Aunt Emma. And Hattie, they were all there together, and it was like going from one house to the next because we all lived in the same basic neighborhood. And thank God my mother didn't mind me going over and spending time with those ladies because they, in some ways, were taking care of her too. So I spent a lot of time away from home intentionally because I didn't want to start any trouble. I didn't want to be a part of any that was started by anybody else. As I got older, I began to understand that usually in those situations, it takes two to tango. And if you can't work out problems verbally, you tend to resort, to physical. And that's what was difficult. My parents were not sophisticated people. They were not educated or learned. So when they had trouble, they had difficulties working them out and compromising. And so I started staying away from home, particularly in Ohio, where I began to know kids at school, third grade, fourth grade. And my teachers in school were really gung-ho on the music. They heard the voice. But right from kindergarten, I sang solos that I had learned in church or learned from my great-grandfather, my grandfather. And so when I was in school, I began to be happy. So interesting. I was so happy. I didn't want to go home at the end of a session. I wanted to stay. So I often stayed after school to help my teacher. I'd clean the blackboard or I'd pick up after we had papers or some mess. And I began to endear myself to every single teacher I had from first grade to sixth grade. But the basic motivation was I didn't want to go home, and they tolerated it, but I stuck around after school. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm very blessed. I'm blessed that I had the teachers that I have had. Teachers are so important in life. And when I started teaching at Middlebury College, I gave myself over to that experience on the same level that I felt my teachers in Youngstown had done. And that is, if a student needs extra time or extra rehearsals or whatever it was, I tried 100% to say, yes, let's get a book out, let's figure out a time, and let's get together. And so it kept me pretty busy, to be honest. But I was very, very happy that I did it, because now when I talk to my cosmic children, as I call them, all of them refer back to the quality of love and care that I shared with them. And they came many times to get that love and that caring, unconditional love. And I used to say to them, well, I'm giving you what Fred Rogers gave to me. Mm. And Fred Rogers gave me such a reason to continue my life and that understanding of my value. And I absolutely am indebted to him forever. That's so crazy. In writing this book, I talked to him a lot. I was sitting right where I'm sitting now. And I'm just sharing with you what a presence he seems to have, even though he's dead. Physically, he's not around, but spiritually, there's an energy that I firmly believe is him. Hmm. And it blessed this undertaking and gave me many of the ideas that I used in the book. I sat here very quietly and meditating, or I began to sing softly to myself. And that's when ideas would come to me, or things that I had forgotten about, I would remember them. and continue my writing. So we're working on the next book.
That's fantastic. I'd love to talk more about the spirituals, which have been an important style of music to you throughout your life. And I'd want to maybe wonder if in a way spirituals became your religion once you started to question the kind of official doctrine of the Christian church. Would you talk a little bit about what spirituals meant to you, kind of how you were introduced to the spirituals and how they've kind of carried with you throughout your life?
Well, I was very young. I went to church with my family and I heard the spirituals, Swing Low Sweet Chariot and There's a Balm in Gilead and Wade in the Water. All of those I heard in church. And I heard my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother sing those songs. So they went into deep into my soul. And when I got to Youngstown and stuff, I was looking for some comfort songs or comfort. I would sing those songs, and they comforted me. I felt wonderful inside. I was empowered. Empowered to do what? I don't know. But I felt very, very strong. You know, as a young person, I was 8 and 9 years old. And the people at the church I went to, they were the first ones who really put their finger on it and said, you know, this boy has leadership. Come on over here. And her name was Madeline. I can't think of Madeline's last name, but she was the choir director. And she said, come on over here, boy, and stand next to me and sing this part. I could sing the bass, not very well, the tenor, very well. And I could sing the alto better than anybody else in the church. I had a high, high tenor voice. And so she was so insightful to use that talent that I had. And so I was doing it in a very amicable way, I can't tell you. She one day said to me, you know these parts as well as I do almost or better. Come over here and teach everybody this song. And she had, and I used to get together sometimes and I would just sing and she would play. She was very fond of me and I was very fond of her and everybody knew it. And so Madeline, I came over there and I started working on a song with the choir, and it was just amazing to me. The basses did what I told them, you know, and the tenors, I sang with them. There were only about 3 or 4 of us. And the altos, I sang with them, boy, and they sang, and likewise for the soprano, which was basically the easy part and the melody. So there I was working on it with them and having a success, and it empowered me that something about the music that I made was convinced them to follow my leadership and to accept that this young child, because I was probably considered a protege, a child prodigy. And I would suggest things that they would do musically, and they did it, and the piece many times improved, or it was more exciting, or we'd do a different arrangement. So that was my where I trained, where I conducted, and where I started writing out parts and organizing them in such a way they became our arrangements. They were special. And everyone would talk about it, you know. Oh, that's a wonderful job that you're doing. Wonderful. So I kept that up for 4 or 5 years because I started out just singing in the choir.
That must have been very empowering to have that positive feedback from the community.
It was. That's the exact word for it, because I began to take on a quality of not just leadership but authority. And I was amazed how people relied on me or sometimes shared certain adult problems. They told me stories and they checked with me. You know, you have your little circle. And I sincerely began to have a small cult. You could call it a cult, because they always came to church. They always sat with me wherever I sat, and they always spent extra time with me. So that gave me an understanding that there were other people who loved music as much as I did. And what I was doing was very much appreciated. So I kept doing it a long time. Even after I left the Baptist church, I was about 15, 16. I took a lot of them with me as friends. They attended their church, but we saw each other. And sometimes I'd go back to that wonderful, wonderful Baptist church. The reason I left was because a social worker heard me sing, and she promised to pay for my singing lessons if I would promise not to miss, not be frivolous, and all that. And I said, yes, of course. So she paid for my voice lessons. And the person that I studied with, Ronald Gould, Dr. Gould was the organist at St. John's Episcopal Church. And he said, if you can come over here and sing tenor solo, Francois, I can pay you $15 or $20. That's what all it was. But I was good money, and it was a wonderful opportunity. So I said yes. And the people at my Baptist church were very, very sad, very sorry. But they said, we understand you're growing, and we can't afford to pay. So we wish you luck. And occasionally they came over to that service at St. John's Episcopal Church. That was like opening a door, because not only did he teach me how to use my voice, he taught me to sing in Italian, French, and German. And it was quite, what is the word, frightening. It was. I was so skeptical and so afraid of so much new repertoire, new stuff. And it just seems like he knew a vast amount more about music than I did. So I listened to him and I enjoyed the music every time. It was so beautiful to me. I had not been exposed to it as a kid at home. So I thrived on this relationship with him. And surely enough, in school, my music teachers noticed the difference. And they were very happy. And they got to know Ronald Gould. And later on, when I was in high school, they planned my trips to college. They helped me decide which one I was going to attend. There was a whole process. And my parents wanted me to stay in Youngstown and work as a, do some kind of vocational work, like some kind of electrical stuff, repairing, repairing a vacuum cleaner or an air conditioner, or be a plasterer or a bricklayer, a tailor, a chef. They're all wonderful things, to be honest. But it wasn't my calling. My calling was music. And so I listened to my high school music teacher, and I said, I want to go to that school that they're talking about, Oberlin. And he said, I'll help you. So what we had to do was we wrote away to Oberlin College, and we gave them my music teacher's address, not my home address. And they sent all kinds of material about applications, $10 here, $15 there, you know, it added up. And the next step was they paid for those applications. My music teachers were just, they were determined that I should have an opportunity at Oberlin College like everyone else. So I accepted their hospitality, their generosity. It was very humbling, but it was also very encouraging that they felt I could succeed if I got there. Now, it wasn't without some objections, especially from my high school guidance counselor, Mrs. Kreisen. She was a Dickens of a mess. She told me I didn't belong there, that I wouldn't be one of them. She said some very harsh things about me accepting who I am and my station in life, making the best of it. And I felt like she was speaking a foreign language. Mm. And I have to tell you what I've said a couple of times because it's true. Diva Clemens sprang up full grown in that room. I'm telling you, buddy. I stood up, actually, and I had a fussing time with her, which she absolutely hated me for, and told her she doesn't know who I am. How dare you try to tell me where I can go and where I cannot go and where I can apply and not, and who I belong with and don't belong with. And the word for it, I flounced out of there. Mm-hmm. I didn't listen for anything else for her. I left her in there standing with her mouth open. Well, she did not take that too well, and she told the principal. And the principal, couple days later, called me into the office. I had been so nervous all up to that point because I knew that he was going to say something. So I went to his office, and I sat down, and he was just a man sent from heaven, maybe one of the archangels, because he said to me, I'd like for you to, first of all, apologize to Mrs. Christ. Some of the things you said to her hurt her very much. I realize, you know, why you had the discussion, and I'm not saying you're wrong. But what I am saying is that she's very hurt, and maybe you could make her feel better if you apologize to her. So reluctantly, I agree. He was a very kind man. I said, okay, I will apologize for raising my voice and how I behave. But it's true, she does not, she cannot tell me what to do and where to go. And he said, you're absolutely right. So thank you very much. Now let's put that aside. And he said, what says you want to go to Oberlin College now? And I thought, well, why is he just bringing up that discussion? And he says, I think that's a wonderful idea. Have you been down to the school? And I said, yes, once. My music teacher took me there, and I sang an audition, and they liked me. They sent a communication that I could be accepted. And he said, well, what are you doing for money? And everything stopped. I said, well, I haven't decided yet. I'm going to go down to the bank downtown. It was a bank that seemed to give monies for people to go to college, especially in Youngstown. And I said, but I haven't done anything yet. He said, well, you don't even have to be 21 to sign a loan or something, don't you? I said, he said, your parents would have to sign. I said, I know they would not sign. He said, well, listen, let me tell you something. I went to Oberlin College, and I want to help you. Is that all right by you? Well, I could have fallen off that chair. All of heaven descended at once. And I thought, Mr. Tier, you'll help me? He said, yes, of course I will. You want to go to my alma mater? You've made an excellent choice, young man. Let's see what. He was so thrilled that I wanted to go. There were only two people in my class, my high school graduating class, that went to Oberlin. And it's only 100 miles from Youngstown. So I listened to him. And his proposal was he's going to present me to the Oberlin Alumni Club of Youngstown, Ohio. So they arranged a date. My music teacher, whom he had been conspiring with without me knowing, said, I'll play for you. So I didn't have to worry about it in the company. And I'll give you a ride out there. I can't tell you what else all they did. But I got myself together and got some music together. And we went out there and we sang for them. And they were so pleased. I have to say it. They were a wonderful, heavenly sent group of people. And when I finished, they said, you can stay just a minute, Mr. Clemens, while we have a little discussion. It won't be long. And I'm sure they were discussing whether they would give me money and how much. Because when they called me in, they said, you'll be pleased to know that we're very, very happy with your singing, your abilities, and how you have handled yourself in the community. Because I did a lot of singing for noontime luncheons and special dinners and special holidays. I was 100% available. And they said, we've decided we're going to help you go to Oberlin. So we're going to write to the admissions people and let them know that your scholarship is going to come from the Oberlin Alumni Club. Will that make you happy, Mr. Clemens? Oh, my God. I was so happy I could have flown out of there, my wings. And they took care of all the red tape, whatever that would involve, and Oberlin accepted me, and my music teacher ultimately drove me back up there with the suitcases and stuff because I didn't have a ride, and I left my parents' home by that time. And it was the most wonderful thing. It opened up another world for me in terms of the people I met and their ambitions. And they, too, liked classical music as much as I did. That was one of the things at home was a problem. I would sing some Schubert song that I was just learning, or Italian song, early Italian, 17th, 18th century, Bel Canto. Mm-hmm. And my parents, if they were there, shut up all that noise, boy, what is that stuff you're singing anyhow? They did not like the Italian or the French or the German repertoire. They didn't know what I was singing, but they said they didn't like it. So I had to go back to school or around the corner to my friend Albert's house to practice singing. I couldn't do it at home. So I left. I left in my senior year, and I was very happy. I stayed with my friend Elaine Logan, who just died, unfortunately. Mm. She was a wonderful friend. And I was complaining about my life in my parents' home, and she said, well, you can come stay with me. I said, what do you mean stay with me? What about your parents and stuff? Oh, I'll ask my parents. I'm sure they'll say yes. She had a very different relationship with her parents than I did.
Sounds like and it.
I was a little skeptical, you know? Because my parents have been so negative. And sure enough, a day or so later, she said, oh, I talked to my mom and my dad. And they said, yes, come on over. We have room and we'll take care of you. Well, well, well. Here we go again, strangers or people who are not related to me by blood that were teaching me something about hospitality, about unconditional love, and about nurturing and empathy. So one day when my parents were gone, I packed a lot of my stuff up. I was ready. My friend Elaine could drive, so she drove the car over, and she came up and she helped me carry my stuff down and put it in the back of her car, in the trunk, what have you. And I left, and I never went back. So, you know, the story in the book I tell, it was a week or two later, at least, when the principal calls me down to the office again. Oh, my God, I thought, what have I done this time? I'm going to get it. Well, when I walked into the office, it was like they're having a summit on the atomic bomb or something. Everybody was there. Mr. and Mrs. Logan, where I was staying, they were there. My church minister was there. Mary Lou Williams, the woman who was the social worker who paid for my voice lessons, she was there. Ronald Gould, the organist, he was there. They were all there, my high school music teacher. And they were all sitting around. I looked, well, these are my peeps, but what's going on? Yet no one told me about this meeting. And my father, my stepfather, and my mother were also there. And so I had such a, you know, it's like that underlying negativity. Something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. Do, 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 do. The music gets all, you know, a warning. Mm-hmm. So when I sat down finally, I was very suspicious of what's going to go on here. And the principal, once again, he managed a very good meeting because there was some enmity between me and my stepfather. He had beat me about 3 weeks before that and left me in very bad shape, particularly my back, where I had bleeding ruptures there. He whipped me with an ironing cord. Oof. And that ironing cord was very, very painful. And I winced and carried it on, but I did not cry. He was trying to make me cry, and I wouldn't. So finally, when he left and my mother left and everything, I went up to my bedroom, and my sisters helped me a little bit. They were not very helpful, but they were young. And so I got myself together, and after that, I never told anybody. It was humiliating to be beaten like that. And so when I was in the principal's office, and they were saying, you haven't been at home, and we think we know where you were, but you didn't tell your parents, you know, you're still under their jurisdiction. And I finally said, no, I'm not under their jurisdiction anymore. I'm over 16, and I'm never going back. And my stepfather at that point got in and said, you'll do like I tell you, boy. If I tell you to do this, you have to. And I don't want to hear all this back talk. And he was very threatening and very negative. So the principal had to say, just a minute, calm down, calm down, calm down, everyone. And I, at that moment, said, look at this. This is why I left. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't wear very many clothes. I had a shirt on. I unbuttoned my shirt, and I turned around, and I let them see the welts that I had on my back and those that were healing scabs. And there was a gasp in the room. What? Principal said, you treat your son like this? Your boy? What's the matter with you? And my father was speechless, but I said, he did it, and I'm never going to let him touch me again. And everyone suddenly were saying to him, especially the social worker, I remember just hearing her say, Mr. Boswell, you can go from here to jail, or you can shut up and listen to what I have to say. She used her authority to calm that scene, to shut my stepfather up. And she said, this is child abuse. You have done something that's against our law. And I can call the police right now, and they will come and get you. So my stepfather never said another word. And the principal said, you know, put back on your coat and everything. And this is something that we need to have a serious conversation about. And he said, I understand you're staying at the Logan's house. I said, yes. He said, well, if Mrs. Logan and Mr. Logan will agree, you may continue. And they were there, and they said, well, of course we will continue. He cannot go back there where his stepfather is unreliable. So I, you know, it was a thing where I had never told anybody how he beat me. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it was important for me not to be shy or feel humiliation, but to tell them the truth. And when I did, the people in authority said, you don't ever have to go back there again. And Mary Lou Williams was a social worker, and I became one of her clients, I guess you could call it, and she saw to it from then on until I went to Oberlin. In fact, she came to Oberlin. I was so amazed when she would show up or call. And when I stayed there 4 years when I graduated, she came to that. And she was a really wonderful influence in my life. So I left that meeting and knowing that I had the official permission never to go back. And basically, I only saw my stepfather two or three times in the years since that meeting. I didn't look for him. I didn't want to see him. So it was always an accidental thing. In a small town, you're driving or going somewhere where we all used to go, and there he is. But if I saw him, I generally just turned and went in the other direction. Mm. And so that was what basically happened, that I got the blessing to stay with the Logans, and they saw to it that I got, they helped me. And other people in the community also helped me to get to Oberlin College.
I got the sense reading your book that Oberlin was a musical awakening for you, but it was also a place of personal change and kind of coming into yourself. Would you like to tell us a little bit about kind of what Oberlin meant to you and the people you met there?
Oh, I'm laughing because you're using such kind, delicate words.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I decided that when I went away to school, I was going to work very hard and be a fantastic musician. That was the first thing I said. Mm-hmm. I want to be considered a great musician. The second thing I said, I'm going to find out what this homosexuality is, this feeling that I have for the same sex. I have something that I can't pretend I don't feel. And nobody in Youngstown offered me advice, good advice, what to do. Everyone was saying, stomp it out, throw it away, kill it, you know, whatever. And I said, I'm not going to throw it away. I'm going to figure out what to do. So when I got to Oberlin, in my second year, I had my first affair. And I let it be known among the kids that I was interested in who was gay and who was straight. And so to speak, kids began to come out of the closet with me and say, you know, I'm gay too. I was shocked at how many of them were gay. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it was a wonderful awakening for me, first of all, because among us kids, it was not so much condemned. It was an adult message that they gave us. You must condemn this. But among my peers, they did not shun me and they did not push me away. I got to know them even better and relationships became intimate. And I do talk about a person in the book that I met and that I knew. And he was what we call undercover on the down low. He didn't want anyone to know that he was bisexual and that we were having an affair. And so I honored that for a very, very long time. So all through my junior and senior year, I was what you would call involved with someone. And it was a very interesting relationship because he had a girlfriend. And manipulating our lives around her was interesting, to say the least. Mm. To the best of my knowledge, she didn't realize that he and I were having an affair. But after we graduated, I can only give you the outline. She did know. And I don't know if he told her or someone else told her. But basically what she decided, and it was very interesting. She said, I know my boyfriend at that time cares for you very much. And I can't do anything about that. And she says, I'm grateful, she said, that it's you. Because if he's going to be like that and going to do it, I don't want him having an affair with another woman. And I don't want him to start another relationship with somebody else. So if you can have a part-time relationship and it won't ruin my marriage, let's see. Well, let's see what's happened. I don't know. She said, I never thought this would happen to me. And I too said the same thing. I never thought it would happen to me. And to make a long story short, when I actually would go visit them. And when I went to visit him, she would leave. Mm. She would go visit her mother, her sisters and brothers, cousins, some other. It was interesting. I barely saw her before she was saying goodbye, going out of the door. Bye-bye. You guys have a nice time. And that went on for a solid, 10 more years. But it started at Oberlin College. So I was not, so to speak, playing the field. I never had that full experience. I don't think I missed out on anything because I was deeply committed to this young man. And he was very interested in me. And he and I have remained friends to this day. I did not give information that he could be found because he said to me, please don't out me. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, our friendship means far more to me than some junk that I might write in a book. So I changed his name and where he was from. I did all those things. And I worked it out with my editor so that there's basically no way to trace him.
Yeah.
And but I very much know where he is and what he's doing for my entire adult life. I could not be openly gay because Mr. Rogers asked me not to be. Mm-hmm. Because by the time I got to Pittsburgh, he and I had a relationship and I was testing, and it was a gay bar in town. I went to the gay bar. I had fun dancing. I mostly danced. And maybe the third or fourth time I was there, I got a phone call from Fred telling me, you can't go back there anymore because people see you, people recognize you, and it'll be very negative for the show. And he said, if you have to do that, come out. I will accept it. You'll always be in my heart and everything I do, I'll be thinking positive about you, Francois. So it's not about you doing that. It's about the risk of supporters, those guys who were at Cheerios or the cornflake, variety. Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah. And the sponsors.
The sponsors. Yes, yeah. Thank you. The sponsors, he said, will not tolerate an openly gay person on a children's television program. Mm-hmm. Oh, he said, they're going to say terrible things about you. And they're going to draw up something that's totally not true, and it's going to hurt you professionally and personally. Mm-hmm. Because lots of people will not touch you because of this. Well, it was a big eye-opener for me. It was like, it's grown-up time. Put on your grown-up pants, and let's get this together, because are you going to be on this program or not? And if you're on this program, what is the sacrifice if you can't have a partner, you can't go out with him, and you could never marry him? At that time, you couldn't marry him. And so it was very despairing. I just broke down crying because I was just experiencing something wonderful. And he was saying, you have to stop. So publicly, I decided I was not going to ever do anything where I drew attention to myself in any kind of a gay situation or with another man. But it also meant that I had to go on the down low with my friend. And I couldn't openly share him. And in many ways, that was fine with him. But it wasn't fine with me. And so I messed around there and I got married to a woman. It was one of the alternatives that several of the guys who were advising me said, you should do. I spoke to my minister, a deacon, an advisor, a counselor, everybody. Oh, they said, don't worry, Mr. Clemens, that's going to go away. You're not a gay person. We can tell. If you were gay, we would know well.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Little did they know. And what Fred said, about being on the program, I thought, well, I don't want to lose the program, so I'm going to go quietly and keep to myself. And for a very long time, I just kept to myself, and I didn't say anything to people. But I discovered that, when the Metropolitan Opera auditions in Pittsburgh, I placed well in Cleveland. I talk about it in the book. I eventually wound up in New York at the Metropolitan Opera Studio. And there were so many gay people around me all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it made me become schizophrenic, because there were those who knew me and saw me, who treated me like another gay person. But then when I wasn't with them, I was pretending to be something totally different than what I was. And most of it meant being quiet. Just keep your mouth shut. And people will not know. People will not become suspicious. They never challenged me, or it was never an awkward situation because I kept my mouth shut. And then to discover how many gay guys there were, it was just mind-boggling for a young guy from Youngstown, Ohio. I don't want to say everywhere I looked there was a gay person, but they were so abundantly distributed in my life. Mm-hmm. Everywhere I went, I saw a sister. So when I traveled, I also found the same thing. I would arrive at a hotel or to some kind of a symposium, and there were always gay people there as well. And with a little bit of conversation and stuff, I would say, I'm gay also. And I made very, very special friends who kind of, it's kind of an underground group of people who had ways of talking, double talk, ways mm-hmm. of communicating, so that anybody who knew what they were talking about got the hint at all. But if you didn't know what they were talking about, you didn't know who Judy Garland was or what, you know, that, you didn't, you know, that, yeah. those are our heroines.
Yeah.
Judy Garland, and when she was in The Wizard of Oz, and you know, there was Dorothy. They would say, do you know Dorothy? And they would ask it very casually, and they would not put any ands or buts on it. And I would say, well, yeah, she and I flew out from New York together. And she's with me a lot. She'll meet you a little later if you'd like. That became a dialogue, I swear. We would talk about Dorothy, Judy, or somebody like that. And there would be people standing next to us around, and they never look up. They never thought it was such a, it was fun to play that little game like that. But that was part of the thing that I had to learn, how to communicate. And I did. And I'm very happy. Newspaper reporters, television reporters, they never outed me, even though several of them very pointedly asked, are you gay? Are you bisexual? What's the story with you? And one of them was the Village Voice. I'll always be grateful to them for simply not printing the fact that the reporter, his name was Arthur Bell, and he's dead now. He was a very sensitive man. I'm very grateful, because he was one of the ones who said, I can talk about this and this and this and this and this. I said, how do you know all that about me? He said, oh, I've been asking around about you.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I began to understand is that people do talk to certain people, and reporters had a way of getting information. But in all those 40, 50 years, they never outed me. I'm so grateful. Thank you, reporters. Thank you, hosts, and whatever else. Because there was a whole lot of them that that did not feel anger or rejected me because I was gay, even if they were straight. And I have to tell you, one of the most famous people in the world who interviewed me was Oprah Winfrey.
Mm.
I went to Detroit. And she was the hostess on a local Good Morning Detroit station. I'm pretty sure it was Detroit. And they showed me her picture and said, she's going to interview you this morning. And what I do remember about this woman was that she was thoroughly prepared to ask me real questions about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. None of this pat-pat stuff. And I found it stimulating. And so after that interview, I remembered her for a long time.
Okay, so you write in your book, it's important for me to establish that I don't think Fred had a racist bone in his body, but neither of us lived in a vacuum. Could you describe kind of how the show dealt with or maybe didn't deal with the question of race?
Well, that's what I think is, you put your finger on it. They didn't deal overtly, in my opinion, with race.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were times when I felt like they were not listening, or they had closed out a certain part of the society because it wasn't a good experience, and they didn't feel they were doing anything negative. And I don't think at that time we as a society, and them particularly, were aware that there was so much entitlement that they shared. They were white, educated, lived in the best, you know, neighborhoods. And so I don't think they fully understood the challenge of living in a ghetto, and or having come from a ghetto, or how other people treated me, not them necessarily, but other people. And I think that was an unfortunate part of our relationship, because I knew it. And I was trying to get them to, hey, like, pay attention. I'm in pain. There's a reason I'm in pain. And you can do something about it, but not if you're not aware, if you're asleep. And I'm sorry, I set myself up as the unofficial diversity officer, because I began to realize that there were situations I would bring up, there would be no response. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. They really don't know what's happening or understand what's happening or what. Why is it that there was no overt response to my importuning them? Pay attention. There's something going on. There's something unusual. This is something that's not right. And so it was very frustrating to me sometimes to deal with them because I was at such a disadvantage.
Yeah,
I was always at a disadvantage. And that disadvantage began to be more and more intense rather than less. Like, I could sing as well as I could sing, and I still couldn't get certain auditions. Mm-hmm. I sing as well as I could sing, and I was never asked to come away to a special Mozart symposium or something like that. It was perfect for my voice, and I know that I sang it well. I find tapes and stuff sometimes on the internet, or somebody will send me something. And I'll listen to it. I'll think, my goodness, that's some good singing. Whoever this guy is, he can sing.
It's Francois guy. He's got pipes.
Yeah, he's got pipes. Let me tell you. And he's using them, and he's using them right. And then, I would say, well, yeah, it's me. But I was so young, and I was not doing it consciously in terms of, I sang a lot natural, but I had a very good teacher. So she enhanced what was already there.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I knew that I could do those things, I thought, well, why can't they see that the reason I'm not progressing in life or the reason I haven't gotten certain advantages is when I walk in, they see that I'm Black.
Yeah.
The only thing that stood out that said, you are different. You are not the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired singer that we're looking for. You're good, but you're just not the right kind of guy.
Could you talk a bit about how you approached the role of Officer Clemens?
Well, to be honest, I took myself out of the picture in order to be in the picture. And I stopped being emotional, and I stopped being deeply, deeply caring. And I said, I'm just going to walk through this part. And the only time I came alive was when I was singing. But the part, as I was acting it, I wasn't doing very much, unfortunately, because I just couldn't get a good grip on being a policeman and the fact that he was kind and empathetic and supportive and nurturing of the other people in the neighborhood. And the way, again, I solved that, I decided to think of the puppets as Fred Rogers, some different aspect of him. Daniel was some aspect, and Henrietta was some aspect, and Lady Elaine, right down the line, Daniel Tiger. So I began to talk to Fred all the time, regardless of who the other characters were. I talked to and with him as Officer Clemens, and I began to warm up and just be myself. It took a while. I won't pretend it did not. And I did what I said I was going to do. For the first year or two, I did not take the uniform that I wore. I did not take it home. I left it in the studio somewhere or in one of the dressing rooms. It was always safe. They knew that I had left it. And nobody ever basically said anything to me, but I was leaving it because when I walked out of there, I was no longer Officer Clemens. I could be myself. And then eventually I found that there was no difference. I was beginning to make Officer Clemens into, I had help, from the cast and from Fred. They all knew that I was fidgety about that role, but that I was trying to make my peace with, and they would do everything they could to help me. What I also was shocked about was how many people wrote into Fred. I got a bunch of fan mail from time to time where people said, not only do they love my singing, but they like the character Officer Clemens. And I was very surprised by that, especially in the beginning. You mean you like him? What do you like about him? And then they, repeat, he's kind. He's can sing beautifully. He's attractive. He was helping Daniel or helping Henrietta Pussycat. And we like that.
So they were really saying that they liked you, basically.
Yes. I had to put it there, out on the table. They liked me. And they not only liked me, because of that extension, they liked the character. And so I just said, okay, I'm just going to be myself. And next thing I know, I didn't have any problems being a police officer, because I knew that I was being genuine about the caring, about the nurturing, the supporting of people. And Officer Clemens really developed into a nice man, so to speak, from in the neighborhood. And everybody liked me. And I sang for all special occasions and stuff they would have. And there were many instances that Fred found to write me into the script over the years. I think I was a big asset for him also because of the race problem. I was black and I was there and I was very active. In the first couple of years, there were no other full-time black participants except as a guest for one performance or two or three. And then later on, there were a couple of people who got involved. Elsie Neal and her daughter. I can't remember her daughter's name, but Elsie is a wonderful artist in Pittsburgh. And the other was Maggie Stewart, who became a regular on the program. And Maggie is incredibly talented as a singer, actress. She does, sign language for deaf people. She's active in the community. Now, you know, she's not a kid anymore. I still think of her as being in high school. And Maggie must be in her late 40s or 50s, you know, after all these years. But Maggie is looks like she's a very light-skinned black person, which she is. And I don't know her particularly ancestry, whether her mother or father were white or anything like that. But she's very light-skinned and totally charming. I love her. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people who looked at her did not know whether she was a black woman or white. And so,
and in the first, and in the first years of the show, I mean, you mentioned being the only black person on the show at first, which probably meant for a lot of your white audience members, you were the only black person they saw, or at least felt like they knew. I mean, because little kids really do feel like they know the characters that they see on television. So was that part of why you took the role, the idea that you could be a sort of, I mean, it's a huge responsibility in a way to be the representative of black America for all these, you know, little white kids. Is that part of what you, why you took the role too, in order to kind of?
Well, I was a little naive and I didn't think I would become such an icon, if you'll please let me use that word.
Sure.
I really thought I would just be a passing character. And so the idea of lingering and having people care about me and getting involved from their perspective was a total surprise. I was not prepared because I had never had anything to do with television and because I was dumb and naive, all of that. So as people began to respond to me in a very positive way, I said, oh, well, okay, that's good for me. Fred likes me too, and I have value to the program. And I think those are the kinds of things I thought about, the value to the program. And yes, I knew that I was often the first black person that they felt who was their friend, or they felt they could talk to white people. Mm-hmm. And I, Fred began to get emails with, or letters at that time, excuse me, which talked about the wonderful things that they liked in the program. And there were a number of them who said they liked our friendship, your friendship with Officer Clemens. And we love it when he comes and sings. I had quite a nice following of people who just out and out said, I love his singing. And so it's the kind of thing where there was a lot of good built into the experience. And one of them, quite frankly, was that I was able to make a living. Mm-hmm. I had money. And the second thing was I traveled. I traveled not only with Fred Rogers. I began to get requested to come and do a concert or do excerpt from an opera like Porgy and Bess, or sing with the orchestra. And they had some arrangements of some special composers like Aaron Copland and a couple of other composers who arranged American Negro spirituals. And I would go out and do those jobs, and they would talk to me about all of them. I was just so amazed. We're watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Whether they were a conductor or instrumentalist. Really, you know, one of the things that we talked about is every single orchestra I ever sang with, there was a member of who had graduated from Oberlin College. And I'd say 30, 35, 40%, maybe more. I knew them while I was there, or they knew me.
Wow.
And they would say to me, well, I was there, but I didn't know you so well. Or I was there and I, you were so busy, you were an upperclassman, I was so young. And then there were, of course, those who knew me, and I knew them. It was a drummer, a violist, a cellist. I knew them. And they played in different orchestras around America. I would just go out and say, well, okay, who do I know this time? And the entire cast used to make a joke of it. Fred would say, yes. Now, France is here, so who went to school with Ross, Officer Clemens? I swear there would be people who were from Oberlin College. Mm-hmm. I boiled it down to the fact, not just me. Oberlin gave them a tremendously fine education so that all over the country, our instrumentalists were playing in these orchestras. I thought that was pretty interesting and uplifting. It was inspiring. And I sometimes would go to dinner with them. I'd sit and chat with them or whatever kind of time I could spend with that person. I got around a lot to many states because I was traveling with Fred when he had not only appearances where he did concerts for the children, he often participated in a symposium on early childhood education like Illinois and Yale and Princeton. And he said, "France, would you like to go with me?" And I said, "Yes, I'd love to." So after I went with him one or two or three times, he said, "Would you like to sing something when you come with me?" I said, "Lord have mercy, yes." So I began to sing a medley of his songs at those appointments and appearances that he did. And the thing that I realized is he had a lot of them, you know, because he would call me. I was in New York, and his secretary would give me the dates and say, you know, "You're not working with Mr. Rogers in Pittsburgh anymore, but can you meet him in Dallas or can you meet him in Miami? Mm-hmm. Can you meet him in Seattle or wherever he was going?" And they would take care of all the arrangements, and I would fly up to present myself with him. And then I would, when we went back to the airport, you know, he went his way and I went mine. Usually I was going back to join the Harlem Spiritual Ensemble. Mm-hmm. But even if I was just going back to New York, you know, I would just go ahead on and leave and come back to New York and get busy with whatever projects I was planning. It would be probably other jobs that I was getting ready for. And sometimes I'd do that. And sometimes I'd have to leave him and go directly to a place where I was due in Atlanta or something, due to perform. And they always helped me with those adjustments. They were not difficult because I wasn't handling it alone. Mm-hmm. Coordination all being handled by my agent and by Fred Rogers' right-hand lady, Elaine Lynch. She was super. And whenever I wanted to do something, I usually called her first.
Could you talk
Yes?
Sorry. I got the sense reading your book that Fred Rogers was one in a series of kind of father mentor figures for you. Could you talk a bit about your friendship with Fred Rogers and kind of what he taught you and why that friendship was so important to you?
Well, first of all, there were a couple of guys who reached out to me. My high school music teacher, Mr. Miller, James Miller, was the first one who made an impression on me and said, "You know, you can have a career. You're a wonderful singer. You have a wonderful voice, a way of presenting yourself. So you need to start thinking about that, young man." Young man. Mm-hmm. So he was the first one. And he really was my friend for years, even after I went to Oberlin and after I graduated. I would come back to Youngstown and go to Rayon School, which is where I got my high school diploma. And I would talk to the kids. Sometimes they had a whole assembly and I would sing to them. Sometimes he would play for me. I've been able to do a lot of singing a cappella. So I would sing a cappella and talk about what it's like to be at Oberlin. And then eventually I carried on over to when I was in Pittsburgh and when I was in New York. So I was like the hometown guy that made good. Getting on a television program like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood ultimately proved to be a big, big, big asset for me in terms of people's attitudes, how they felt about it, and their desire to go ahead and have me come and visit and pay a real fee. So I was very grateful for that. The other thing about father figures was Ronald Gould was my vocal teacher, and I studied privately with him for 3 years. And once again, Ron saw a special talent that he thought was something he could connect with. And he taught me my first songs in German, French, and Italian, as well as many songs in English. The thing about Ron was he had no children. He was married to a beautiful lady named Marcia. And they kind of adopted me. They lived not too far from where I live. So I wound up having a dinner at their house and staying with them and singing, having a voice lesson. First was every Wednesday. And then he began to add days, and he began also just to say, "Can you come by the house this evening? Are you busy?" And heck, I would say, "No, I am not busy. And I think Ron understood that I was trying to get away from my home, because I began to stay a great, great deal with him and with Marcia. And he was the one who prepared me to go to Oberlin, the repertoire that I sang. And then the other music teacher was the one who drove me up. So they were working together. And they were like big brother fathers, you know, as a brothers slash father figure. And then when I went to Oberlin, I stayed very much in contact with my principal from high school, and Mr. Tier. And I knew his family also. He had a son, Philip, at Oberlin, and we were very close. And Philip was 10, 12 years young, older than I am. And so he served as a kind of big brother for me in, within the family. There were lots and lots of things that happened to a young student along the way. And quite frankly, one of them was I didn't have a winter coat. And I told Philip, and he immediately took me shopping and got me a winter coat. And there were other things. Philip and I were very, very close. And I would talk with him and let him know some of the problems I was having. But they were usually financial. But he said, don't worry, I know who to talk to. I know what to do. And it really helped that he was a member of the Oberlin College staff. Mm. He worked somewhere in admissions, but I wasn't sure. And so he was there the whole time that I was there. And so it's like God sent me an angel to kind of look over me, look after me. And then the main thing when I finally got to Fred was that I realized more and more that I would watch how my peers were behaving with their moms and dads, particularly at Oberlin. They came up all the time and they sent these care packages and on and on. I thought, damn, nobody's sending me anything. So when I got to Pittsburgh and I sang it at the church where Fred was a member, and ultimately his wife introduced me to him. And then I met him and I did a Easter for Good Friday program of all American Negro spirituals. And Fred was so moved and so touched by that performance, that presentation, that service at the church, that he said, I want to have lunch with you and get to know you better. Can we please get together? And I said, well, yeah, as long as you're paying for it. And of course he said yes. And then we finally got it together and we went to Stouffer's. And his wife and the organist, John Lively, at the church all came along. And we were talking. It was very casual, very positive. And then after a drink, they said, okay, I have to go. I have this to do or I have that to do. And I thought, well, where are you going? You haven't ordered the meal yet. The real stuff. And I always think that's kind of funny. They had their mind on one thing. I had mine on another. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line was that they had set us up so that I would be comfortable and happy and spend my time there with Fred. So they left, and he and I stayed at least for 2 hours. And I always say he never stopped listening, but I never stopped talking. And he was a great listener, I'm telling you. He set the bar pretty high. And he was genuinely interested. I discovered he was interested in everybody. Everybody talked to him, and everybody told him their most intimate secrets sometimes. I was allowed sometimes to sit in the room or to be in the near vicinity of him, and I would listen to what they were saying. I never, ever talked about it. And occasionally, he and I would speak about it privately after it was over. And he would explain something about them or what the problem was, how they were going to handle it. He was very, very generous with me, but I didn't overstep the proper professional bonds that way. But the time Dr. King got killed in 1968, April 4th, I was living up in the Shenley Heights. And Shenley Heights was a black bourgeois section of town. Bourgeois means that they were the doctors, the lawyers, the judges, the preachers. All the black professionals lived up there. And I found a wonderful attic apartment, absolutely wonderful, and got to know the people who owned the house. And the wife had a baby, and I spent time with her and the baby and stuff. It was like family again. And sure enough, when this Dr. King got killed, Pittsburgh was just a blaze with, and Detroit and Newark, Chicago, Los Angeles, almost every city, Memphis, Nashville, Atlanta, Birmingham, up. They went up in fire because black people were so distraught, just like they are right now. And I often find it very difficult to understand. Yes, you could be angry, but why burn your community down? The people who have stuck with you over all the years, who have their shoe shop or their little grocery shop or their, cleaners, little shop, flower shops in your neighborhood, and you burning those down or tear them down or break in and take everything. And those people who have dedicated themselves to surviving in the ghetto, everything is lost. Just everything. It's like having a flood come in or something. It's ridiculous. And so anyway, I was at home and they were rioting in Pittsburgh in the Hill District, which is right adjacent to Schenley Heights. In fact, they were all one neighborhood. They just gave my little neighborhood a different name. Mm-hmm. And I could see from up there in a garret, I called it a garret, in the attic, I could see the fire coming up and smoke after a while. I thought, Lord, you know, it's only like 5-6 blocks from where I was staying. Well, I got this phone call and it was Fred. And he said, Franz, how are you doing? I said, well, I'm here. I don't know. And he said, well, we heard on the news that the hill was on fire. And we know from the numbers and the addresses, it's not that far from you. I want you to put something in a suitcase and John and I are coming to get you. And I said, oh, I'll be all right. No, don't worry. I'm spending time with the family here. No, we're going to get you out of there. I'll be right over. Bye-bye. And he hung up the phone. Well, they came and they got me in less than a half hour. And I remember when I was throwing stuff in the luggage, thinking, he's trying to show his care and his nurturing person to me as a single kind of lost boy, and still a boy in town, that there were people there who cared about me and they cared about what happened to me. And they were going to commit themselves in a way I don't think anybody else had ever committed themselves to me in my life. And when he came with John, they were very kind and solicitous and reminded me to get a toothbrush or something, you know, that I forgot. And we went downstairs, got in the car. I went home with him. And I stayed about three weeks. And during that time, he became my father. We talked quietly. I participated in the family with him and his two boys. Wonderful, Johnny and Jamie, and his wife, Joanne. There was like there was no new person because everybody belonged there. Up on the third floor, he had 3 or 4 extra bedrooms. And sometimes Mr. McFeely, who played Speedy Delivery, and Lady Aberlin and the rest of us would stay on the third floor. And, you know, it was like a regular part of their home. I used it probably more than anybody else because I needed the emotional support. And so I came back from New York to be in Pittsburgh sometimes when I had absolutely nothing professionally in the studio to do. And that was okay with Fred. He gave his secretary instructions to talk about when I was coming so that it would be a time when he was going to be there. And it'll be interesting for me to see or whatever what he was doing. And so I did that. And so there were times, obviously, when I was in New York, I'd have 3, 4 months, 5 months with nothing to do, no jobs except a church job. And that was not going to pay very many bills. And I was lamenting, oh, dear, it was so difficult. Fred said, well, just come home. He always called his home in Pittsburgh my home. Just come home, friends, and stay here a couple of weeks until the next job comes. And you know, and you can go back to New York. And so that's what I did. And this one particular time when I came to Pittsburgh, I was in the studio and he was filming like regular. He had guests and what have you. And it was I was standing in the shadows, but at the very, very end of the show, and he sings, it's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. No, tomorrow, we'll start the day tomorrow with a song or two. 1, 2. Tomorrow, we'll start the day tomorrow with a smile for you. Till then, I hope you're feeling happy. Till then, I hope your day is snappy. Tomorrow, It soon will be tomorrow and be our day. We will say a very happy tomorrow to you. Johnny Costa would go off playing something. And he would, you know, go through that process where he takes off his sweater, puts on his jacket and shoes, and steps out of the door back into another world. Well, what that particular day when he said that, you are, I love you the way you look, imperfect, just the way you are, and I like you like that. I was staring at him, and I swear he was staring at me. So I walked around the studio till I got to the point where he was about to come off stage, and we stood there until Johnny finished playing the music. And I said, Fred, were you singing to me? And he said, yes, I've been singing to you for 2 years, friends, but you heard me today. Well, it was like they pulled the lever on the Hoover Dam. I started crying. I couldn't stop. The tears were so profuse. I saw, it was like the heavens opened up also, because it was like a lightning bolt. You know, if it strikes and there's all this light all of a sudden, it doesn't last just a second. That's what happened with those words. I like you just the way you are, friends. Well, of course I'm talking to you. And I just started crying and I fell into his arms. And he comforted me and said, I'm always going to love you. I'm always going to take care of you, friends. I told you that. You should know that. And if there's any problem or anything that's going on in your life, you should come to me and discuss it because I am here for you. Well, I mean, I never had a man, an adult man, say, I love you. Mm. I know that sounds very strange. Why should he? Well, my father never said it. My stepfather never said it. I had uncles who I knew cared for me, but they never said it. They never said, I love you, friends. Fred was the first one. And something inside of me switched. It came on. I came on. And I was so full of acceptance of myself and joy. And he put his arms around me until I got myself back together. And we sat very quietly and had a short talk about the fact that everybody needs somebody in this life. Mm-hmm. So don't feel bad if you don't have it, friends. But when it comes to you, you have it too now. And you have to really know that. You have someone who cares about you too. And you don't have to go through life looking, feeling lost, begging. Daniel sings a song about, was I a mistake? And so I was asking myself privately, am I a mistake? And Fred said, no, you are not a mistake. You belong right here with us. So they became my family, and I began to think of going home for Thanksgiving and certain holidays. I went back and stayed with Fred and Joanne and the two boys. And so that was my life-changing experience that made me whole. It made me feel warm. When I was singing or going to auditions and stuff, I think, well, Fred loves me, and that's all that matters. I'm going to go in here and sing my heart out, and nothing anybody does or says is going to make me do less than my best work. And I found that I began to get jobs. Lots of things were just more positive in my life because I was loved, and I knew that I was loved.
Well, Francois, I've taken up so much of your time, and I want to really thank you for talking with me for the show. I really enjoyed the book, which once again is Officer Clemens by Francois Clemens.
A memoir. Officer Clemens, a memoir.
Officer Clemens, a memoir. Thank you. I don't want to forget the subtitle. All right, Francois, yeah. Take care. Thanks so much for doing this.